Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to Season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story. An epic true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 16, The Greatest Lion. In 1197, after the French disaster in Flanders, Philip was forced to make another treaty with Richard, this one stating that if Richard were to die, any future treaty between the two rivals would require Flemish approval. Even more to the point, the new treaty said that John would be the one to strike the deal. So was Richard's brother Lackland moving toward renewed status as Richard's heir, rather than Richard's nephew Arthur? Well, of course, no truce could be expected to last for long, and a comet in the July sky predicted evil to come. Choosing the harvest season of 1198 to go at each other again, there was a set-to over a couple of French castles on the Franco-Norman border. The French fared badly again, winding up in a small but bloody fight just outside Gisors' walls. Lionheart's battle cry that day was Dieu et mon droit, which translates along the lines of My rights come from God, eventually to become the motto of the British monarchy, long appearing on British passports. God certainly was on Richard's side as that battle flared. Philip's men were getting the worst of it and went racing across the Gisors Bridge into the town. The story is that the bridge collapsed, dumping Philip along with half of his infantry into the river, while Richard won more than 100 prisoners to be ransomed. Many valued Frenchmen died that day, and Philip was obliged to make his way to Andely for yet more negotiations, where he no doubt stared through narrowed, appraising eyes at the enormity of Chateau Gaillard. There's a famous old story that Philip sniped that he could conquer Normandy even if the great castle were built of iron. Richard shot back that he could hold Gaillard against his French rival even if the walls were built of butter. Philip still had a little Arthur of Brittany, Richard's named heir, at his court, but otherwise he was in a sorry way. The loss at Gisors had been bad. Not only were former allies departing for a triumphant Richard's side, the wavering, impulsive Bretons, the House of Blois Champagne, and Philip's best soldier, the Count of Boulogne. But new energy radiated from Rome, where a pope named Innocent III had very recently taken his place on the throne of Peter. Not yet 40, Innocent had just begun a career that would make him one of the most formidable pontiffs of the Middle Ages, eventually having his hand in events from Norway to Constantinople, Canterbury to Sicily. He took his place on the stage at a time when there were innumerable problems crying out for a heaven-based power to guide earthly monarchs. The Muslim victory at Alarcos. Dynastic turmoil in Germany. Endless warring between Plantagenets and Capets. Sicily wanting to overthrow its resented German overlord, and, greatest of all, the sacred obligation to launch a new crusade to do what Richard hadn't done, take Jerusalem back. The marital troubles of Philip Augustus alone could keep a pope busy for days. Philip's family history was ripe with domestic problems. There was his distant grandsire and namesake, Philip I, crazy for Bertrand de Montfort. There was his father's luckless first marriage, not to mention Philip's efforts to break free of his own first wife, Isabel of Hainaut, back when he was a very young king. Isabel had managed to stick at the time, eventually giving him his only living son, but she had died in childbirth while he was at Acre. After several years as a widower, Philip had married the Danish princess Ingeborg, a political arrangement based on some very, very old claims the Danish royal family had to the English throne. Given that the French king voluntarily offered for Ingeborg's hand, it's impossible to guess what unanticipated deformity of body, face, or spirit repulsed him within hours of the wedding. But whatever it was, Philip Augustus quickly announced his intense displeasure with his new 18-year-old queen. Exiling her from his presence to virtual imprisonment in the countryside, Philip had a fake genealogy drawn up to prove that consanguinity prohibited their marriage, and submitted it to Rome with a request for a quick annulment. The French king evidently assumed Rome would favor his view of things and quickly set out to find new feminine companionship. His first effort fared poorly. Philip offered to marry the daughter of a noble Burgundian family, but while the Lady Marguerite would indeed go on to spawn babies which, over several generations, led to Mary Queen of Scots, it wouldn't be with Philip. Arguing forcefully that Philip was already married, a prince of Savoy waylaid Marguerite while she was on her way to meet the French king and married her himself. Seemingly none the worse for wear, resilient Philip became entranced by a new lady, named Agnes of Moravia, heiress to a small German seacoast province. Agnes apparently was another of those medieval lovelies able to set a king agog. Half Bavarian and half Slovene, Agnes might well have been the green-eyed, creamy-skinned blonde beauty of a million erotic fantasies. Chroniclers reported breathlessly that her silky hair reached the ground, and that she was not only staggering to look at, but an expert huntress, capable of knocking out a stag or a boar, with a grace that enchanted the court. Well, the French court may have been enchanted, but the Pope was less so. An annulment from Ingeborg was not forthcoming. It didn't matter to besotted Philip, who adamantly refused to give Agnes up, Pope or no Pope. The king was willing to risk his soul for her, leaving the Pope to sort out how to deal with the moral threat to France. In short order, Agnes became Philip's consort and new queen, while the old queen, unhappy Ingeborg, was kept in virtual solitary confinement in one after another of her hostile husband's fortresses. She would spend the next 20 years fighting to be returned to what she strongly felt was her rightful place on the French throne, repeatedly petitioning two successive popes, her family, and those French nobles who sympathized with her for help. Philip, in turn, went so far as to swear she was a witch who had made him impotent on their wedding night, thus proving that the marriage had never been consummated. She insisted that she wasn't, He wasn't, and it had. The two kept at this for 2 decades. The king's loathing for the lady didn't ebb until he was on his deathbed some years later, by which time Ingeborg's decades of bleak confinement had almost driven her to suicide. Even among the multitude of unhappy marriages of the time, theirs stands out. All of this was tiring. The French king was being ground down at home, encircled by Richard's allies abroad. Philip needed a truce, and so back to Andelay they all went to sign another of their perpetual, largely worthless treaties. By this time, the air was so thick with mutual distrust that legend says the two kings would only address each other from a distance, Richard standing in a little boat on the Seine, while Philip sat horseback on the riverbank. Delegates no doubt shouted themselves hoarse when they weren't wringing the river out of their robes. All of that damp effort produced a mere squeak of a peace, with a life expectancy measured in weeks. Negotiations or no negotiations, Richard launched construction of forbidden castles, while Philip Augustus made a fresh stab into Normandy. But the Pope held his own cards. With both Ingeborg and Agnes on his hands, Philip in particular needed the Pope. So Innocent's demands for peace in Europe to enable new war in the Holy Land carried genuine weight with the French. Thus, new peace terms were crafted, including Philip Augustus's son marrying a Plantagenet lady. Not his actual betrothed, the unfortunate fair maid of Brittany, once again to be set aside, but a different girl, another of Richard's nieces. Richard, in turn, was to pay over another 20,000 silver marks and give up all claim, in perpetuity, to Gisors. The paperwork required nothing but Richard's return from Poitou to sign it. At the time, Lionheart was in the foothills of the Massif Central, the volcanic plateau in south-central France, where he was paying calls with his siege machines upon various uppity nobles in the vicinity of Limoges. It was late in March 1199, one of the first days of the last spring of that remarkable century. Richard was in the midst of another of his cyclical fights with the independent-minded Viscount of Limoges. The unreliable Viscount couldn't be allowed to drift into the Capetian orbit. And if it took besieging one of his castles, then Richard was the man to do it. The Viscount had such a castle off to the south, at a little place called Chaloux-Chabrol. It was nothing dramatic, a rather ordinary small stone fort behind its walls. It didn't even have a full garrison on hand to defend it. Why Richard took the trouble to go there, rather than just leave it to his captains to deal with, became the stuff of myth. The story that's come down the centuries is that the king's attention had been drawn to this drowsy place by something Richard both loved and needed. Treasure. Fighting perpetual wars was expensive, especially for a monarch whose people had recently paid for an unsuccessful crusade, shipped tons of silver east to Germany, and built Chateau Gaillard. There were rumors that gold had been found at Chabrol, although the rumors were vague. No one was quite sure, but the story says that Richard, overlord of the castle, intended to get his share of it and had come to make his demand of Chabrol's owner. The legend is entirely doubtful, modern historians focusing instead on the political need for Richard to place his thumb squarely on the Viscount's head. But there's a telling moral center to the old story. Given what happened to this wondrous king, the world's greatest warrior, in an ordinary place on an ordinary spring afternoon, men of the day struggled to find some way to make sense of it. Richard had come through innumerable battles, through sieges, through a crusade, through imprisonment by his enemies unscathed. God's finger could only have moved as it did now in response to some sin, like greed. No other explanation was understandable. There was no such thing in 1199 as simple bad luck. Not for a king. Certainly not for Lionheart. For that matter, it's entirely fair to say that Richard, so sure of himself that he'd long sauntered right up to, if not over, the thin edge of recklessness, brought his bad luck on himself. On this particular day, he ate dinner with his men, then felt like one more run at the stone walls of the little castle on the crest of the little hill on the edge of the great plateau. There are several stories about what happened next, people's grip on fact immediately muddled by shock, fear, and grief. Most mention a defender who had amused the attackers all day by warding off incoming arrows with a smartly wielded iron frying pan. As Richard came up, the same soldier aimed his crossbow. The archer, whose name may have been Pierre Bazille, fired off a bolt. Some said his target was just a knight who was sitting his horse in just such a way, turned just so, that there was an unarmored gap between his shoulder and his chin, probably for no more than half a minute. Others say the knight wore no armor at all and was instantly recognizable. Whatever the truth, the bolt hit the knight's shoulder at 130 miles per hour. The knight was Richard. There are several versions of the bowman's name, none of which are even vaguely similar to each other, chroniclers calling the man variously Pierre, Jean, and Bertrand. Nor is there agreement among the reports as to whether Pierre or John or Bertrand was a grown man or a boy. For that matter, there isn't complete agreement as to the date Richard was hit. What seems to be true is that the bolt went deep, although this warrior who had seen 1,000 battlefields seems to have barely flinched. One chronicler said that most of Richard's men at first had no idea he'd been hit. When he could get back to his tent, he tried to pull the damn thing free himself, probably amid a clamor of worried squires and captains bringing water, toweling, basins to catch the blood. The wooden shaft broke off in his fist. Surgeons were called, but they botched their job in the post-dusk torchlight. Worse luck, they obviously hadn't read the Roman medical treatise, which would have warned that the moon was in Taurus, ruler of the head and neck, and one never touched with iron that part of the body ruled by the sign the moon was transiting. It was a grim prophecy. In the next days, they probably bled him, but it wouldn't have done much good. If he was lucky, his doctors damped his pain down with opium and hemlock, but nothing fixed the stubbornly dripping wound or the massive infection it dumped into his bloodstream. Perhaps they imagined, trusted, prayed that nothing could kill him. He lived 10 days. The end of Lionheart's life was separate from everything that had gone before. One would have expected clashing swords, plunging horses, screams, banners, the sweep of armies, the high passion of triumph or despair. There was none of that. Just as there was none of the intense penitence favored at the more devout deathbeds of his time, the cross of ashes, the naked prostration, the revelation of lice-infested hair shirts. Richard had never been known as pious, and there would be no spiritual about-face at his end. As for Pierre, if that was his name, he was caught and yanked along to Lionheart's camp, crowded with surgeons, knights, messengers waiting for orders, frightened locals calculating the price they'd pay for this disaster happening on their watch. A popular legend, which might be true, holds that Pierre admitted he knew what he was doing, that he had recognized Richard and aimed right at him, because Richard had killed Pierre's father and brothers during the incessant warfare in the area. Pierre apparently was resigned to being hanged, if not worse, for killing a king. But it's said that Richard pardoned him and gave him money, that favored Lionheart boon. Eleanor got to her beloved child's bedside in time. Richard was 41 years old, dying in the spring, the season that would never lift its fingers from Eleanor's pulse. Now 75 herself, she had lived in a world of dynasties set rocking, palaces, wars, mountain sunrises, kings and popes, coronations and crusades, intrigue behind closed oak doors, great open cloud-tossed skies alive with hawks. After she had exerted her mighty efforts to free Richard from the Germans while simultaneously controlling John, she had followed the path aging noblewomen of her day often took. She semi-retired to life inside the famous stone walls of Fontevrault, that graceful community of noble widows and annulled wives, where she could still be called upon to consult, to mediate, to settle scores and solve problems, with a particular eye on her Aquitaine. Fontevrault was where the riders found her when they slammed their horses to a stop and delivered the message to come as fast as she could. She got to Chabrol in time to sit beside her favorite son while he died, his eyes slowly drifting further and further from her reach, until he was entirely gone. The other woman we'd think would be there, his wife Berengaria, wasn't. She only learned of Richard's death after the fact, from Fontevrault's abbess. One observer, the Bishop of Lincoln, said the news reduced her to hysterical weeping. Perhaps she truly had loved her utterly remote husband. Perhaps, more to the point, she understood what she faced as a childless, powerless former queen. The sparrow forever in the shadow of the old eagle, Eleanor of Aquitaine. For the rest of her life, Berengaria's letters and charters would be signed as Most Humble Former Queen of the English. The lady, who rarely appears to be a woman settled into a happy life, would have a particularly difficult time of it after Richard's death. She would live on for 31 years, more than half of them spent fighting with John Lackland over money she was owed as Richard's widow and former queen. Never remarried, as many widowed noblewomen were, often entirely without any income, Berengaria had to rely for life's basics on her sister, married into the House of Champagne, and kindly friends. No less than Pope Innocent III described her as a destitute beggar, and took up the battle on her behalf, hounding John to pay the pension due a widowed queen. Under threat of interdict, Lackland made many promises, but then pled poverty time after time, even when prodded by his own mother. It wasn't until John's son took the throne in 1216 that Berengaria's accounts were settled. Some 60 years old by then, she finally was able to take up a more congenial life of charitable and religious good works. She ultimately was instrumental in founding a Cistercian abbey, Notre Dame of Holy God, at Le Pau, near Le Mans, where she died and was buried. The abbey itself was to endure many centuries of shifts in its fortunes, then finally saved and restored in the 20th century. Berengaria's remains themselves suffered from at least two rounds of vandalism, but were found during the abbey's restoration. She's now peacefully interred under her effigy in the rebuilt chapter house. The effigy shows her feet resting on a lion, which pins a small dog beneath its weight. The lion's claws are visible but not distended, its expression watchful rather than aggressive. The dog lies submissively. Perhaps in this small detail, the unknown sculptor added his own postscript to the story of Lionheart and his faithful queen. Richard had made some final bequests before he died. He left his jewels to his nephew Otto, who sat on the throne of the Holy Roman Empire. He had his heart sent to Rouen, to be buried near the tomb of his older brother, young Henry. We know that the royal embalmers took great care with it. Centuries later, in 2013, a team of forensic historians analyzed the powdery remains. Richard's heart had been treated with a rare and costly mixture of frankincense, that ancient perfume associated with the birth of Jesus, myrtle, daisy, mint, mercury, and possibly lime to preserve and protect it. It was a gesture of infinite respect. It's generally agreed that Richard, making a rare jest, left his entrails at Chaloux, where they were buried in the chapel. It's possible his brain went to what was then the great Abbey Church of Charroux in Normandy, already in its 5th century, a legacy of the Dukes of Aquitaine, his mother's people. The rest went with his mother to Fontevrault, his mother who told people, "I have lost the light of my eyes." She saw to the funeral, accompanied by 5 bishops and abbots, and to the burial of her son's royal remains. For the last 800 years, Richard's effigy has rested at his father's feet, staring eternally into the plain stone vaulting of the abbey's chapel ceiling. We probably should note that none of the actual remains buried there survived. It's commonly thought they were variously destroyed either during the Huguenot convulsions of the 16th century or during the violently anti-royal French Revolution in the 1790s, but no records exist. As for the location of Lionheart's brain, the cathedral at Charroux eventually fell into ruin and the relic was lost. Most critically, Richard died naming John, his last surviving brother, his heir, despite having once said that his nephew, Arthur of Brittany, would become the next ruler of the Plantagenet Empire. Thus, traitorous John, the same John who'd been entirely barred from England while Richard was on crusade, who'd tried to have Richard kept in a German prison forever, who'd made a destructive pact with Philip Augustus, sour, clever, damaged John, vaulted over a boy who was too young, too inexperienced, too weak, too tied to Philip Augustus. John may have deserved it by the thinnest of margins. He'd been a source of steady support to his brother in the council chamber and in the field for some 5 years by now. There were so many problems with both contenders, but perhaps John was truly less of a risk than a boy with one foot in the Capet's tent. Perhaps John really was the best thing for the kingdom. Perhaps. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again, April 21st, for the next and final episode of Lion's Forge. Available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.